protection and government effectiveness. And as a note for the beginning, just for any of you that are here on maybe a couple of bills, I'm going to carry over the work session on 2174 till next Tuesday, and I'm going to carry over the public hearing and possible work session for 2496 to next Tuesday as well. So with that, we are prepared to do a work session on 2175. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2175. Wendy, you want to remind us about that bill?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2175 deletes a requirement that state agencies file with the Division of Audits of the Secretary of State documentation of business reasons for the exceptions to the next day deposit of funds with the state treasurer. Deletes the requirement that commodities commissions file annual financial statements with the Division of Audits of the Secretary of State. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. The bill has been found to have, sorry, I've got my old version of my statement. I believe it's been found to have no revenue impact and also either no or minimal fiscal impact.
Stand at ease for a moment.
Just a second here. There is a dash one amendment for the bill, which was brought forward in the meeting and was discussed at the meeting on the hearing on Tuesday by the Secretary of State's office. And the fiscal impact statement for the bill, as amended, or also in the introduced version, has minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Wendy. So I will entertain a motion on the dash one amendment.
Madam Chair, I would move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2175.
All right. Representative Rayfield moves to adopt the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion? All right, is there any opposition? Okay. Then the motion passes. Okay. And so now I will entertain a motion on the bill.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2175 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass amendment.
Okay, Representative Rayfield moves House Bill 2175 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lagos?
Aye.
Representative Hovey?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Aye.
Vice Chair Buhler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, and the motion passes. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2175. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2549. And Wendy will tell us what that's about.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2549 allows state agencies to decline to assign debt of an estate to a private collection agency if the estate has closed. The bill would apply to debts owed as of the effective date. The bill declares an emergency and is effective July 1st, 2015. Right. And the bill has been found to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and there are no amendments at this time.
Right. Representative Greenlick and Nicole Gulish?
Gelish.
All right, please state your name and proceed in whichever order you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I appreciate your hearing this bill and hopefully working it today. It's a very simple bill brought to me by Ms. Gulish. And it turns out that the Revenue Department is required to turn debts over to a collection agency, even if the collection is against an estate that has been closed. What this bill does is it allows them not to do that for which they appear to be very happy. I don't know if I can ask Ms. Gellish to tell a story. That's what we're here for today.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Gellish, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2549. I had a very frustrating experience with PERS regarding my deceased mother, Berta Delman, and definitely feel change need to be made. Berta died in December 2006, and her estate was closed June of 2008. As her executor, I was used to occasional odd pieces of mail over the years. However, I was taken aback when in April 2013, a notice from PERS arrived stating there was an overpayment made to her in 1999 and they were seeking recovery. I immediately contacted PERS and explained the situation. After providing the necessary information to PERS, which they had requested, I was under the impression the matter was closed. But then in August of 2013, a notice and demand payment notice from the Oregon Department of Revenue addressed to Berta Delman, deceased, arrived. And I again contacted PERS to let them know that she was deceased and the account, her estate was closed back in 2008. Thinking the matter was closed, I was really upset to find that in April of 2014, Premier Credit of North America was sending a notice to my mother, not even saying that she was deceased. The PERS had handed her collection over to them as a debt collector. So I called PERS again, and they told me that this three-step progression is their legitimate process to collect even if the person is deceased and the estate is closed. After my upsetting experience with PERS, I decided to write to my state representative. I really just needed to vent my frustration and get confirmation of PERS' system of overpayment collection. I'm very pleased that Representative Greenlake responded quickly and effectively to my concerns. I wholeheartedly encourage this committee to make changes to how PERS handle accounts for deceased beneficiaries and their closed estates. I have not heard from PERS since April 2014, so I'm hoping they have closed the matter on my mother. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Holby.
I'm just curious have you contacted PERS to find out if they've closed it, or you just haven't heard from them?
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
No news is good news.
Thank you. I was just worried that they hadn't responded to an inquiry is all.
Well, you contacted someone at PERS, and so we have had a string of emails that they confirmed that this was their three-step process and that the only way to change it was to change.
And their point was, Madam Chair, members of the committee, was that it was a Department of Revenue problem, not a PERS problem, that they simply had unpaid debts. Although it seemed pretty odd to me that they finally got around to a 1999 overpayment. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was its own craziness in this thing. They started asking for it 15 years later, but that's a different matter. But they referred me to DOR.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
That's a whole other concern. Why are they debts 14
years ago? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2549 and open a work session on House Bill 2549, which is the bill we just heard. So. And I will entertain a motion on House Bill 2549.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2549 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holvey moves that House Bill 2549 be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Yes.
Representative Holvey?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. Right. And with that, the motion passes. And is there anyone in particular who would like to carry this bill?
I'd be happy to carry it.
All right. And it will be carried by Representative Greenlick. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2549. Do I need to reopen the work session to assign a carrier to 2175? Do I need to reopen the work session? Because I forgot to assign a carrier to 2175.
Matter of form, I guess.
So for to be safe? All right, quickly, I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2175 for the purpose of assigning a carrier. And Representative Stark, would you like to carry your first bill on the floor?
Sure.
There won't be a hazing. All right, so Representative Stark will...
Don't make promises
on the record. Okay. So Representative Stark will carry House Bill 2175. So I will close again the work session on House Bill 2175. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2383. Wendy?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2383 requires people soliciting purchase of business opportunities by telephone to make certain disclosures before completing a transaction, and the bill defines the term business opportunity. The bill becomes operative 91 days after the effective date. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. The bill has been found to have no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but the fiscal statement has not yet been issued. There are no amendments to the bill at this time.
Okay, so with that, I will call forward. I'm going to go first names, if you don't mind. Cheryl, Jean, and Janet. And go ahead and state your names for the record and proceed in the order that you wish.
Thank you. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I am an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. And here today on House Bill 2383 with me is Jean McDonald. Jean was brave enough to send us a consumer complaint in our financial fraud consumer complaint hotline. And she's here today to share her story. Also with me is Janet Forth, and also an assistant attorney general who worked with the cases and is here for technical advice as needed. I'd like to first give a short overview of the problem this scam has shown us, and then give a brief overview of what the bill does. So as you know, the Attorney General enforces the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That's our main consumer protection law. And what we do is we look for patterns and practices of bad behavior out there. And sometimes when we find a particularly bad pattern or practice, we come to you with a smarter enforcement idea. And that's what we're here for today. The quick overview of the patterns we saw here. Basically, this was a scam that can start sort of small and then spiral into a much larger problem for consumers. Sometimes, and usually how it would start out, was with a banner ad online that said, and maybe you've seen these, my sister's brother's boyfriend's uncle made $5,000 last month on a work-from-home business. Click here to find out more. And typically, this is targeting folks who maybe have a little bit more time on their hands or maybe are on a lower fixed income and looking to make a few extra dollars a month. What the scammers are really looking for is the phone number. And once they get a hold of somebody on the phone, they begin selling the product. The work-from-home businesses can range anything from sort of credit card readers or a sort of website that is called a... website mall, where basically you just have different links to other sites. These sites are like hundreds of others, and they provide no real value. That leads into other products that these scammers will start to sell. Leads that are not worth anything. Coaching, business services, and you'll hear Jean talk about some of those. It's especially dangerous because you know, a lot of consumers will say, hey, this doesn't sound quite right, or I'm not making any money yet. So what they'll do is they'll send a check for $50 or $100 here or there to keep them in the loop. Or they'll continue to try to sell them hot leads for other products. So, and that can lead to other problems as well. This consumer then will go on sort of a hot list and be sold as basically a commodity to other scammers, saying this person likes to buy things and so forth. So as you can see, this starts out maybe as a small scam but can quickly spiral for the consumer. Over the last while, we've been collecting complaints on this issue, and Oregonians have lost over $1 million. So that's the problem. Quickly, the solution. This behavior is already an unlawful trade practice, but what we're trying to do here is stop the spiral from getting too large and stopping it at the beginning. What we do with some scam-prone industries in this area already is allowing them to, or just requiring them, sorry, to simply register as a telephonic seller. This puts them on our radar, and it allows us to say, if we're getting complaints on somebody that's already been registered, we have a name, we have an address, we have a way to contact them to work out the complaint. If they're not registered, which is usually the case, then we can quickly send them a letter saying, you're not registered, we've got a complaint. And usually they will just get out of Oregon at that point, and that's what we're hoping will happen here. So happy to answer any questions. And Jean is here to also share her story. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Just state your name for the record, and then.
My name's Jean McDonald. And I imagine I got contact originally from because I had been scammed once before that for $5,000, which I swallowed, think no big deal, okay, I've been had, but that's I think is what tuned me into more people calling me, and once, like she said, once you're on the list, everybody's calling you, and I was in need of some extra funds at the time, and so they started making phone calls. And they made it sound really, really good. And they were saying that this was a business card thing for other small businesses like myself. I have some properties. And that they were helping small businesses get loans and being able to use credit cards, get a credit card or get a credit rating where they couldn't get it before. And so it's supposed to be good for me. I got a part, they got a part, and the new businesses got a chance to get started. That was their main thing. And then they come up with that name, Aflac Assist, and saying that they were associated with Aflac Assist, and when I questioned them further down the line, that they assured me that nothing, that Aflac would never allow anything that wasn't above board to come through them. So anyway, they end up hooking me for some money in for leads and selling me leads about six at a time. And somehow or other I realized that they had access, once I give them my credit card number, that they had access to know exactly how much credit I had on that card. Mm. And so they knew I had more money to spend. So they were hooking me to go on further. Mm. Said, well, you got so much money to spend, you got this, you can, if you'll double what you've already got, you'll make more money. And it just keeps getting further down the line all the way. And they were guaranteeing me. And they did send, like she said, the small dividends from the first two groups that I was involved with. There were about six in each one of them. And I got small dividends, like $50 from one, $400. And it didn't even pay the interest on the card, but there was small amounts coming down. And then on top of that, they associated me with, insisted that I had to have an LLC. And of course I had to pay for that on top of it and tell me how many benefits there was to having an LLC and all that. And then they just, after they turned me over to the other company, that's when I began to get suspicious of what was going on. And then along the line, suddenly, they had sold me another group of leads, and I was getting those little benefits on the first two sets of leads, but on the third one, nothing was coming through. And that's when I began to really question what was going on. I started asking asking questions. And I had a particular man that I was supposed to contact who was supposed to be my coach and the one that's supposed to take me through everything. His name was Michael Casey. And of course, he had a big story and really suckered you in all the way. But all of a sudden, I couldn't get through to him anymore. And after they'd sold, and they had that one set of cards that hadn't actually cleared the credit card yet, that I had 90 days for it to go through or cancel it. Well, all of a sudden, I needed some questions answered, but I couldn't get through to him anymore. And he managed to get me past the date so that he got the next $5,000 or whatever it was. And so they really work you. But anyway, when the thing that actually sent me through to them was that somebody in Florida got a hold of my name, and they called me and said, hey, I understand you're having problems with Aflac Assist, and I'm a lawyer, and I can show you how to get your money back. So here we go again. Fortunately, that was only a few hundred dollars that I gave him. But when he got a hold, and when I found out, he had my credit cards. But he didn't only have the last four numbers of my credit card. He had the full number of three major credit cards. And he had in his access. He knew who they were, how much money I had on them. He knew everything about them. And then after that, his partner, when someone associated with him, took my cards and actually was running up small amounts of debts. I don't know what it was, $300 or $400 or something. That's when I called, and the credit card company contacted me. And they told me to get hold of the police at that time. And the police were the ones that told me to get hold of the Department of Justice. And that's how I got there.
Wow, well, thank you so much for sharing that story. It sounds like an awful situation, so thank you very much. Did you want to testify as well?
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice's Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section. I might just touch on one thing that hasn't been covered yet today, and that's the definition that we created for who is and is not subject to this registration requirement. We tried to be smart about that as well, and so we heavily lifted almost pretty much in its entirety language from a Federal Trade Commission rule. That sets out certain disclosures that home business opportunity sellers need to make to consumers. And so hopefully that means that the business is only doing one set of analysis to determine whether they need to register or not.
One quick question that I have probably for the attorney, the deputy attorney generals, is can you explain to me kind of your current, I mean, I understand what the UTPA is, but kind of what your current, so when you heard Gene's story, what kind of actions can you take? And because it sounds to me like you're saying these tools will actually allow you to kind of cut this short a little bit quicker versus only hearing about it once. Clearly, you know, quite a bit of damage has been done.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, certainly a false statement to a consumer is actionable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. One of the challenges that our office faces is that we have an information flow challenge. So at the first consumer complaint, and of course a small percentage of consumers are brave enough to make a complaint to our office. And so we'll get that first complaint and say, okay, there's something here. Is it enough to really trigger the response that there's a big scam against Oregonians? Maybe not, because we have a consumer saying, this company told me one thing. If we can get a hold of the company will deny that. So it just takes some time for us to kind of ferret out those patterns. So in the case of, in some cases, by the time our office has really put the picture together, we may not be able to track down that company. It may be a little bit of a fly-by-night, and so, or their assets may have dissipated. In some instances, we have been able to find some restitution, and we also have some unsatisfied judgments. So we're working on it, but we think we could do more.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I'm curious, in speaking about the restitution piece, does the consumer in this part have the ability to get an attorney and take action of their own to recover their losses?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, members of the committee, yes, there's already an ability to bring an unlawful trade practices action. This bill merely adds an additional tool for the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Just to clarify for my understanding of all this, in the summary it refers to certain disclosures, and if I understood your testimony just a moment ago, those disclosures are basically in the realm of registering what type of business it is. What would that first of all, is that correct? And what would that process of registration be for those businesses?
Representative Stark, Chair Fagan, members of the committee, the bill summary is maybe a little misleading because what we're doing here is adding to the number of businesses that need to register as telephone sellers. And once you do that, you need to make certain disclosures to the Department of Justice. And those disclosures are laid out in, I believe it's 646-557. And that involves paying a fee to the Department of Justice, letting us know where's your business, who's your contact information, and providing some basic information. We do have a form. I think if this bill passes, we'll revisit that form and probably make some tweaks to make sure that it works with this new law.
Yes. Was that a yes?
Yes.
Sorry, right, thank you, Chair. So are there, I'm assuming there's plenty of legitimate businesses that are registering under this, that this would, for those businesses, would this suddenly now they have to register when they didn't previously, and now they have a new fee that they have to pay? And what is that fee?
Chair Fagan, Representative Stark. So the fee is $400 for 1 year. We have about a dozen that have registered with us. And specifically with these work from home businesses, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has done a study and found that 1 in 55 is legitimate. So we're happy to work with them to get registered and everything. And it's $400 a year.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So that confused me a little bit. So you said several have already registered. So I thought we were passing a bill to say they have to register. So why would they have already registered?
Sorry about that. Yes, Chair Fagan. So we already have a registration requirement for some scam-prone industries, and that's the ones referring to, like people who sell precious metals and a few other very scam-prone industries. So those are the 12 I was referring to.
And so this just expands the list.
Correct.
To basically all telephonic solicitors.
This expands the list to all solicitors for work at home business.
Okay. And any other? Oh, yeah, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Ms. Heimstra, did I hear you right? You said 1 in 55 is legitimate or is illegitimate?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, 1 in 55 is legitimate.
The odds aren't all that good, are they?
Bad odds.
So my final question, I think, is do any other states have a similar registration for that's as encompassing as the one that we would be asked to pass? We know?
Okay. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, Arizona does have a registration requirement.
Okay. Do you know if they're the only other state? I'm just curious if, you know, if we're particularly vulnerable in Oregon to these businesses, you know, taking advantage of our population because we don't have a registration requirement.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, Florida and Arizona, who have incidentally a high retiree population, are a little bit ahead of the curve. And so I don't know that I would, maybe the way I would characterize it is we're trying to solve a problem, but not all states have been trying to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for indulging me. Any other questions? It's very interesting. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2383. You're kind of giving us a little bit more information, so I don't think I'll work that way now. I think I'll hold off on that one. And open a public hearing on, I don't see Representative. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2532. Representative Witt. All right, I think I'll, and I don't see Representative Parrish either. So we're looking,
there he is.
Come on down. You can go ahead and read the summary.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2532 requires a lender or an agent or affiliate of a lender to provide a summary of certain provisions in advertisements and communications intended to induce consumers to apply for or enter into reverse mortgage contracts. The bill becomes operative January 1, 2016, and applies to reverse mortgage transactions occurring on or after the operative date. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. It has been found to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and there are no amendments at this time.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Brad Witt, representing House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of House Bill 2532. I want to emphasize that House Bill 2532 is an effort to address deceptive advertising practices that surround the advertisement of reverse mortgages. I want to be extremely clear that this bill does not address reverse mortgages itself, only the advertising practices. I am not appearing before you about reverse mortgages, and I will tell you that I personally have no problem with reverse mortgages. In fact, to the contrary, unfortunately, in an era when we have declining numbers of pensions, and those pensions that that remain in this country oftentimes being inadequate to carry people financially through an entire retirement, and personal savings being oftentimes in a similar condition, reverse mortgages are increasingly becoming an important tool in people's financial futures and in their retirement. I think all the more reason then why House Bill 2532 is an important bill, and if these are going to become increasingly important instruments, we've got to get this right, and we have got to eliminate what I believe are deceptive advertising practices. Reverse mortgages are simply an opportunity for folks to borrow against the equity in their homes, people age 62 and older. And then the entire loan typically would become due when one of three happens. The borrower dies, the home is sold, or the home ceases to be the principal residence of the borrower. Now, this instrument is, as I indicated, oftentimes serves very well many people's financial interests. However, the problem arises, or problems arise, as you will see here in a moment. Oftentimes, advertisements on TV, the Sunday morning news show, or also afternoon soap operas, those apparently tend to be times when they attract a very large number of senior citizens, making up a large part of their audience. References are typically made in many of these commercials, and this is the sales pitch: how seniors may remain in their homes under reverse mortgage, how they may eliminate their monthly mortgage, in the process obtain tax-free cash, and enjoy the lifestyle that you want to live, all the while you retain complete ownership of your home. And as you'll see, they even reference there's no catch. No catch, because it's government insured. What these advertisers obviously fail to mention, and I believe are purposefully trying to hide, is what I mentioned to you earlier. The circumstances under which that loan has to be paid, repaid in full upon the death of the borrower, the sale of the home, or occupancy cessation. I'd like to now, if we could, show a couple of advertisements, which I think will indicate some of the deceptiveness here.
Things sure have changed, haven't they? I mean, with the economy the way it is these days, it's no wonder that thousands of seniors have turned to One Reverse Mortgage to take control of their retirement. Hi, I'm Henry Winkler, and I'm here to tell homeowners that are 62 and older about a great way to live a better retirement. It's called a reverse mortgage. So here's how it works. When you call the experts at One Reverse Mortgage today, you'll learn the benefits of a government-insured reverse mortgage. It will eliminate your monthly mortgage payments and give you tax-free cash from the equity in your home. And here's the best part, you still own your home. Now call the number on your screen and let One Reverse Mortgage help you live a better retirement. Does that sound too good to be true? Well, listen to what a reverse mortgage did for these people.
The first thing I did was paid off all of our credit cards. Totally.
I can breathe now. My bills are getting paid.
We're traveling more. We're eating out more.
Call One Reverse Mortgage now and get your free DVD and Retirement Your Way booklet, which will tell you more about how a reverse mortgage works and if it can help you. You can receive cash in a lump sum or monthly. It's cash that you can use to pay off your credit card bills, your medical expenses, actually anything. And the best part is, the cash does not affect your Social Security. Take advantage of the equity that you've built in your home with no monthly mortgage payment. One Reverse Mortgage is the largest reverse-only mortgage provider in America, and their mortgage experts are licensed professionals you can trust.
If you're a homeowner 62 or older, call One Reverse Mortgage to get your free DVD and Retirement Your Way booklet. Plus, when you call now, you'll get this magnifier with LED light absolutely free.
Take control of your retirement today.
You know, some people have told me reverse mortgages sound too good to be true. I mean, you get cash out of your home, no monthly payments, and you still own your home. There's got to be a catch, right, Jesse? Well, there isn't. It's like any other mortgage, only with a reverse mortgage, the loan's paid back when the last borrower leaves the home. In fact, reverse mortgages are based on a notion that President Reagan signed into law over 25 years ago in order to help seniors remain in their homes. They're simply an effective way for folks just like you to get the cash you need to enjoy your retirement.
Call 1-800-840-1677 now to receive a new free information kit, including a reverse mortgage guide and DVD, personal stories from people like you, and a brand new family guide for children and loved ones, all absolutely free with no obligation. With a government-insured tax-free reverse mortgage from AAG, you always retain complete ownership of your home. Call 1-800-840-1677 to receive your free info kit today.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are examples, and again, reverse mortgages are a very valuable tool for a broad spectrum in our society. But I would suggest that the reason for this bill is because this is deceptive advertising. This bill is an attempt to accomplish truth in advertising, and contrary to what Fred just said, there is a catch, and that catch is that this loan needs to be paid in full when one of the three instances that I have mentioned a couple of times now occurs, and that payment typically has to occur in full when the term ends. I think it is important that we make sure that our senior citizens have the full facts up front. This bill would require them to divulge in clear print or in audible voice form that they will be paying the piper at the end of the term of a reverse mortgage. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that you have. And I would certainly hope that the committee would act favorably on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gallegos?
Thank you, Representative Witt. Do you have any data with regard to how popular this is, any numbers with regard to how much use of this particular vehicle is?
I actually, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, asked for some of that information, and I think there's some folks that are working on that right now. It is becoming increasingly popular, and there is a rather significant and recent increase in the number of defaults on in these mortgages. Now, I don't want to leave you without further commentary on that. It may not be the vehicle, and it may have as much to do with our recent economy as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Representative Witt, I don't know, maybe I'm not 62, or so maybe I don't get it, but that didn't look like that was all that factually problematic, those commercials there. Or maybe I don't believe the Fonz would lie to me. But can you tell me what's going on? Or just the part about you still own your home, is that the part that you think is factually incorrect?
Yeah, you still own your home in full. It's accurate up until the point that after you've died and your spouse is left homeless because she can't afford to refinance, may not be able to get a refinance for a variety of reasons, or your heirs try to refinance the home and can't be added to the loan, or a whole host of reasons, that home is then gone. And I think there is a catch. I don't see where there is any harm in making sure that people know that when you die, when you sell, or when you cease occupancy, that you pay the piper. And that's what this bill is about.
Thank you.
Representative Boldy.
Thank you, Representative Witt, for bringing this bill forward. I know we looked at reverse mortgages several sessions ago, and when we looked at some other subprime mortgages and predatory lending practices, and I know at that time I think DCBS felt they had enough authority over reverse mortgages to take care of misrepresentation and misleading advertisement. And so I'm curious what their commentary on this is. If they're not able to deal with this, this bill is right on target. I'm kind of curious what their perspective on this bill is, and what your conversations with them have been about this issue. Have they said that they're just not able to deal with this kind of advertisement, or what's anyway? There's a question.
Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, I really have not had in-depth discussions with DCBS about this because, again, the focus of this bill is advertising and not the vehicle, not the mortgage vehicle itself. So I'd be happy to talk with them, but I really haven't gotten into it, again, because it's focused on advertising.
I just had a quick question you have to pay it in full when someone dies, they sell their home, or they cease to occupy it. And you had given the example, and I just want to make sure I understand it properly. So if a husband and wife enter into a reverse mortgage upon the death of either of those individuals, then the entire amount has to be paid in full.
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, what oftentimes happens, and first of all, I have said typically what happens, and I think this the vast majority of reverse mortgages, that's what happens. Certainly anyone, as a matter of contract, would be free to enter into a different kind of mortgage with a lender, but that's typically what happens. With that said, again, typically, it is oftentimes there is more equity available to the older spouse. Presumably, lenders have less time frame that they're exposed to risk. The older spouse is going to die sooner, probably. And so more equity is available to the older spouse. Oftentimes those mortgages are entered into strictly in the name of the older spouse. More money available to live the lifestyle that you want. And so when that happens, the older spouse dies, that younger spouse is going to have to find a way of either refinancing that mortgage, coming up with a new mortgage, or they're going to have to leave the house. So there's probably no other alternative that I can think of.
And so the reason they generally put the reverse mortgage in the older, spouse's name is because if they're looking at repaying the entire mortgage over the period of that person's lifespan, you're going to get larger payments on the individual that's older. My understanding?
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, the individual who borrows may have access to a greater amount of equity. The lending institution may be willing to loan more money, a greater sum of money, and again, presumably because there's less term of risk, shorter term.
To follow up on Representative Rayfield's things, thank you, Chair Fagan. But to follow up, you're talking about the structuring of the reverse mortgage, not the advertisement for the reverse mortgage, or is that what you're saying? Because I think now you're getting outside of the 30-second commercial.
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, I was responding to a question, and I have tried to make it abundantly clear in my presentation here today that I am not here to talk about reverse mortgages. I was asked a question to which I responded. I have no problem with reverse mortgages. I personally believe that they are a necessary instrument for a lot of people in today's society.
Okay, thank you.
Just one question that I... No, you're just rubbing your mustache?
Yeah.
Okay. No, let the record reflect that Representative Buehler is just rubbing his mustache. Not that cool. We are dealing with the Fonz here, so I had to see. So my question is, and that's actually is because of our last presentation, so I understand that you're asking for a bill that would require certain disclosures. Already under the UTPA, a false statement in advertising is already actionable. So is it just a matter that that's just not being enforced? I mean, you've certainly stated a couple of statements that you believe in these commercials that are just flat false. Do you think they're just not quite UTPA material, or they're just not being enforced? Is that kind of the idea for doing something in addition, requiring some express disclosures?
Madam Chair, we all sat here and watched that video, and I don't know if any of us saw the star, the little bitty microscopic star that would suggest that you better go read about reverse mortgages. It is there, and what this bill does is it suggests that if it is a print advertisement, that it be larger than the surrounding font. Or that if it is a verbal commercial such as this one, that disclosure be made in an audible fashion such that the average person would hear it and be forewarned, presumably then pursuing a reverse mortgage with eyes wide open.
And I will admit I did see the star. But my husband has not quite convinced me to have that big of a TV in our house, so I probably would not see it on a regular-sized TV. So any other questions or comments? Okay, great. Well, we are also going to hear from Bob Tackett of the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans and John Bartholomew, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon.
Chair, anyone else coming up?
I don't see Bob in the room.
Okay. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew, Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon, and we just wanted to put on the record that we support this legislation. We have policies regarding I'm sorry, I was distracted. So, we have policies supporting honest advertising for financial transactions, financial products, and in particular, this is something that affects a lot of our members. We have heard certain circumstances nationally. I haven't heard situations right here in Oregon about cases where, just as the representative had described, you have the older person was the only name on the reverse mortgage, and they passed away first. And because the house was bought, or the reverse mortgage was bought during the bubble, the amount that the surviving spouse currently owes is more than they could possibly do, and they're left finding another way to live. So just wanted to put us on the record supporting this legislation. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Mr. Bartholomew? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2532? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2532 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2780.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, state rep from House District 37, and bringing you today House Bill 2780. I will just start by saying we did pass your bill unanimously just now. So
yes, thank you.
Committee's over. We're not missing committee to be here. So, in the 4 years I've been in the legislature, I have never testified in front of this committee. I tend to be somebody who thinks that sometimes some of the bills that come out of here are a little bit, you know, like not my thing, and I certainly could not be accused of being pro-business, but I am here today because of a situation that, you know, we're starting to see more of. I personally talked to constituents about, but Steve Dean from the Oregonian this past summer actually really brought the issue to light when an elderly couple went through the real estate process, and you have the articles there for you, but an elderly couple in Portland went through the real estate process and were pretty much defrauded of their property, and didn't feel like there was a mechanism where they could, other than going back to the courts, and they, of course, had no money because they'd been defrauded of their property, to go back into the courts. It really was what I would call the resolution for this particular case really was a crowdsourced anger fixed the situation. And I don't think that every time we see a case of financial elder abuse that it should take a newspaper reporter and dozens of angry comments on a newspaper article to change a legal transaction. So, House Bill 2780 would strengthen some of the existing elder abuse laws that we have. You're going to hear from the title folks, and they've given you some testimony, and I will certainly address some of their things ahead of them giving it about why they have concerns with the bill. The first page of the bill is simply some cleanup language. That's not the substance of the bill. So, but what this bill is asking is that when a property goes through an escrow, and I will add that not all properties go through escrow, and going to and trying to figure out how properties that go through just a county clerk with a quit claim deed and no, you know, real estate professionals involved is a whole other problem for a whole other day. But when a property is going through escrow, and the seller of the property, the principal of the property, is 65 years or older, and there is a standard kind of a deviation of 20% or greater from real market or assessed market value, this bill is asking for a disclosure form at sale so that that those numbers can be calculated and somebody can actually look at a document that says the appraised value is $500,000 and your sales price is $100,000, or the real market value is $300,000 and you're selling it for for $60,000 less or greater, you know, is this something you want to do, and ask the person to sign to it. There is a language drafting error, which the land title folks have brought. I'm on line 7. I'm happy to fix that, because the goal isn't to have them explain the an escrow agent explain the entire terms of the sale. The goal is, as you have, if you've ever transacted real estate, and somebody who's closing will say, this form does this and this form does that. We want that process, this document, to be added into that process. It was interesting, because the lobby and one of the land title folks were in my office today and said that, you know, well, for title insurance, if we feel like there's fraud, then, you know, we could not issue title insurance. And then, of course, maybe the transaction doesn't go through. So it's not unheard of where an escrow agent or somebody who's in that capacity on the titling side, it sounds like, has some is a little less neutral. And their concern about neutrality, I completely understand. You know, you want to have neutral third-party people in a real estate transaction or in transactions. And, in fact, the quote from one of the articles, Dean Owens, the deputy commissioner of the Oregon Real Estate Agency, said it's not to pass judgment on whether you think the deal is good or bad. And that's not what we're asking here. What we're asking an escrow agent to do does this transaction look or kind of feel like it is under coercion? Somebody who doesn't understand or have the capacity to enter into that transaction, the bill does not say you shall stop the transaction. It says you can still conduct the transaction. There'll be some concern that's brought up about, well, you know, is the appraisal subjective or objective? And under our appraising laws and under the professional code of ethics that appraisers are required to maintain, I feel that a buyer's appraisal is completely a good number to use in terms of, are we selling a property for less than market real market value by 20% or greater? And obviously the tax assessed data is, I would consider that absolutely neutral data to use in that type of disclosure form. So we're talking about a very small population of people who are selling property. It's not everybody who's 65. And 65, for those who are new, it tends to be the year and the age that we have hinged almost all of our elder abuse laws on. So you'll hear from Representative Greenlick, who doesn't like that number. But the fact is that's what pretty much everything else that in the last 4 years since I've been here on elder abuse that we've done. You will hear that this bill was not work grouped as part of the elder abuse group. Frankly, if we work grouped every single bill that we did, we'd never get anything done, or things would get done much slower. So I think that there are a couple easy changes that we can make to this. But the notion that anybody should be neutral in a situation where a elderly senior citizen, a child even, you know, that anybody's neutral in that is problematic to me. And I struggle with that. And of course, we all on our first kind of week of school went down to our mandatory child abuse reporting, and all of the questions got asked about what's reasonable if you see someone texting in the car or, you know, or smoking in the car, like, is, you know, are we mandatory reporters? And I think a reasonable person would look at a real estate transaction that is being sold way under value and somebody doesn't seem to understand the papers they are signing and say, there's a problem. And we're not asking the escrow folks to be skilled psychologists or have an understanding of somebody's medical condition. We're asking them to notify DHS and say, hey, we think there's a problem. We have laws after a real estate transaction has occurred that would allow for if DHS came in and needed to get somebody criminally involved to prosecute somebody, we already have laws that would help with reclamation of property or value of a property and then put somebody, you know, away. We're not asking the title company folks to do any of that. What we are asking is to put a document in front of somebody when there is a clear, you know, cause of somebody who is selling something that it truly has value, and we know how to, you know, recognize what that value is and say, do you really want to do this? And they don't even have to ask the question. Just sign the form, you know, read through the form. We're asking you to read the form. So I, again, tend to be somebody who doesn't show up in this committee and bring these types of bills. But I think at some level, we all can feel a little outrage when we see a population of people who are you know, really being taken advantage of. I have a woman in my community who owns a very nice piece of property, and she is constantly being barraged by people who want to develop her property. It's suburbs and the metro and high-density housing, and they lowball her. And fortunately, even at 86 years old, she is still of sound mind that I wouldn't drive up her driveway because she might be likely to pull a shotgun, and defend her property. And she knows to, every little inch of her property line, and she knows exactly what that property is worth, but not everybody does. And we clearly saw that play out this summer very publicly with the case that happened. I think that by and large, people who are professional and hold licenses in this state really don't like to see bad actors in their own field. You know, whether it's a teacher who sexually abuses a kid, or whether it's a lawyer who's corrupt, or a doctor who has malpractice. I mean, I think all of us just, and people in those professions just kind of cringe when they see that happen. And so this isn't to say title companies are, turning a blind eye on purpose. It's to say, hey, right now there's nothing in the law that says really for them to step up and speak up and have a voice. For those who are new, you may not have received, and I submitted it as part of this bill, but our DHS office did a very good job of compiling an elder abuse, financial elder abuse, and I put forward one page of the report. I would certainly encourage you all to read it because the data in it's very good, but I bring forward this particular page 8 of the report because the reality is other than family calling DHS, it's those evil bankers who are actually doing the good work of reporting financial abuse in our state. Without a bill, without a law, bankers have taken it upon themselves to, create a toolkit for their industry. They are doing training as part of on-the-job training of things to spot. And so it is the financial industry through banks and credit unions who are the front line of defense after family for making sure that financial elder abuse isn't happening. In this report, on some other page, I don't have it with me, but you will see that while real estate fraud and elder abuse is a small percentage of the actual instances, the value, obviously, with real estate being what it is, it represents a very large scale financial value of elder abuse that's happening. And, this is going to continue to be an issue, I think. A lot of these are not like the newspaper case of a realtor team kind of gone bad and swindling their neighbors. A lot of this is familial, and that actually makes it much more difficult to kind of step out against a child or a cousin who's maybe is a caregiver, step up and say, I'm in a situation where I'm being abused. And so, you see on this list clergy, they're not talking to their priest or other people who might be, close to them. They're not talking to their doctors. It's, very, very small percentage of other types of people are these victims going to. And so in a real estate transaction, the mortgage guy, that's for the buyer. The realtor may or may not be, there may or may not be a realtor representing the folks who are selling the property. There may be one involved for the buyer. There is no place that I can find in a transaction other than at that sort of neutral signing of documents, would there be an opportunity for someone to have a seller to have one last look that, yes, I actually want to do this, and yes, I'm not being swindled, and yes, I'm not losing property value. And you're going to have situations where you're someone 65 and older is going to gift their child piece of property, and you're going to go and transfer title, and there might not be any real market value or change of money that happens. Will they have to fill out this form? Yes, and most people in those scenarios, they're really just gifting their property or whatever to their kids. But, there is a population that is, we're starting to see more of this, and I think as the sort of baby boomer generation ages, and they hold a vast majority of real estate, this is going to continue to be a problem. So I think it's a simple fix. I think it is stopped short of declaring that they have to be mandatory reporters on every transaction, and strengthens our elder abuse laws. I am absolutely willing to come in and make sure that it's that line 7 on page 2 is fixed in an amendment process. You will hear lots of reasons why this won't work or we need to spend more time with it, but I'm going to humbly disagree, and I'll take any questions.
Okay, questions. Representative Stark.
Rep. Parrish, thank you for your testimony. I know you've referenced line 7 on page 2, but I'm trying to reconcile a comment of what I think I heard you say versus line 5 on page 2. I understood you to say that they can still close the deal, but I'm reading line 5, and maybe I'm just not understanding the way it's worded, where it says that they cannot accept funds, property, or documents.
So may and shall in our statutes are two very different things. So this is permissive in that if somebody really saw something egregious, like the situation where an elderly couple was selling their property for 10% of its value, this actually would allow an escrow agent to say, we're not going to transact this deal. There is no liability in this bill does not put liability for transacting the sale onto escrow agents. So if it had said shall not accept, then of course it would absolutely stop the procedure. And our goal is not to hold up the real estate transaction. We understand that those things are timely. We understand that mortgages are, usually have sort of a end date where they need to be transacted, or you could lose your rate, or et cetera, et cetera. So our goal is not to stop it, but our goal is to put a tool in the toolbox where essentially if somebody suspects, based on a transaction, based on the signing of that document, that they need to make a call to DHS, then we're asking them to do that.
Representative Holvey.
Just to follow up on that point, I not saying that you're entirely wrong on that, but I'm a little concerned. Would want to definitely check with legislative council, because saying may allow something or may accept or shall accept are different things. Mm-hmm. But when you say may not accept or shall not accept, I'm not so sure that those are actually different. So,
and Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I will happily, since we're going to clean up line 7, I will happily ask our alleged counsel for some clarity on that. And if we need to make that adjustment, we will, because again, the purpose is not to stop the real estate transaction. If it needs to go through, it goes through. And then we have other mechanisms on the back end if a crime was actually committed.
Follow up?
Yes.
And I really appreciate that you're trying to protect children of the 50s and 60s. But I'm also curious is if this is good policy for real estate, why wouldn't it just be a universal application to everybody?
I actually would have no problem doing that. In fact, your colleague, one of your colleagues, told me that her own child went through a process like this. Her son and daughter-in-law went through a process in your caucus, and she's like, we should just make it for everybody. I'm willing to, admit that is something we could consider, but this was brought really in the context of a lot of the senior elder abuse that is happening and to strengthen those laws, but you might even get more protest if we opened that up wider.
Holvey likes protests. Other questions? Rayfield. Representative Rayfield.
I think the one question that I have is actually, will this solve the problem? I think the problem makes a lot of sense in trying to fix it, but we already have elder abuse statutes in place that this actually would fall under. And probably in a lot of these cases, and this is my question, these folks probably avoid actually going through, as in this case, there wasn't a realtor, there wasn't, attorneys involved, and they kind of skirted the normal, I guess, folks that would probably ethically or professionally said, hey, we're just not going to get involved in this. So for people who are not using those avenues, how does this bill affect them?
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, yes, in this particular case, lawyers and other realtors besides the one who was a part of this were not used, but there was an escrow agent used. And so it's that putting kind of in that fresh set of eyes, I think would help. Does it stop people from swindling old people? It absolutely doesn't. Does it help us identify and recognize somebody who is a victim and, help them to maybe have a mechanism to go out and have somebody from DHS come in and step in and at least do the check and make sure that that person is in an okay situation? I think that it does that. Again, dealing with transactions that are happening at the county clerk's office with no title or no escrow, different bill, different day, maybe a good conversation to be work grouped in that larger process, because that really becomes a little bit more complicated, because you wouldn't have these types of disclosure forms happening at recording at the county clerk, or at least not all of them potentially. So does it stop the entire problem? No, it doesn't. Does it put more people potentially from being victimized or recouping losses if they have been victimized? Yes, I think it does.
Thank you. Representative Bagels.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. As you point out, I mean, with the aging population, I mean, essentially most of the wealth is actually centered in population that 65 and older, because it is in real estate.
Right.
And I think that anything we can do to protect and make sure we're not abusing those folks. Another idea, really, to follow up on Representative Hovey's idea is that, I think it was Hovey, even just doing this as a pilot, and if it is working mm-hmm. fine, then think about the other populations.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Go ahead, Representative.
I'm sorry. I don't know if there's other people to testify on this.
There's a couple others.
It does occur to me that sometimes there may be reasons for transactions like that, that it may be, the value may be much less, and there used to be things like other considerations that would reduce the value of the transaction. And it just seems like you're putting the escrow agent in a kind of an odd spot to determine whether that other consideration that affects the value of the transaction is valid or not valid, I guess. So I don't know. There's just some ambiguities there. I'm just trying to figure out in my brain.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hovey, I think, you know, you heard in our mandatory reporter, we all read statutes every day, and there's ambiguity for us in terms of, do we report child abuse or elder abuse, or what does that constitute, or, you know, when do we step in if the mom's yelling at her kid in a shopping cart or whatever, or left her kid in the shopping cart, is that child abuse? What's reasonable for us? And certainly in a one-hour training, I don't think we get a chance to cover all of that. So again, the goal here is not to put all of that burden on the escrow. The goal is to get the escrow folks to notify the right people, who then can come in and make that determination the same way we would if we were making those determinations. I think it is not an easy position, and it is a kind of a deviation from where you know, escrow has been currently treated in the laws. And you're going to hear, you know, well, the law says, well, you know, we also got the little button that says we're supposed to come here and try to, you know, change those things, I think, as the situation merits. And so it's not going to be, I think, an easy black and white. But I think in your gut, if somebody shows up and clearly doesn't understand, you know, what they're signing, like a reasonable person, when we get back to that same language we use in other mandatory reporting aspects of the law, a reasonable person might be able to look at that and go, yeah, that's a problem. You know, you're absolutely right. You could sell a piece of property for any number of reasons, for a repair allowance. You know, this woman in my district who has this nice piece of property, the house is completely degraded. Someone's going to have to just come doze it someday. And so does that change the property value at sale? It might, because you're going to get rid of the house and have the expense of removing the house. Is she still making the determination, as she's signing that form, this, you know, and it looks very clear of, you know, mind and spirit to be making see that there is a deviation from her property value or assessed value? That's what we're really looking for here, and that's going to take a little bit of judgment and a little maybe less neutrality in those particular instances for that escrow agent. And again, limiting it to people who are 65, we're then talking about a really smaller population. You know, I'd like my family just to gift me their stuff, right? And I might have to go fill out this form too when we get there. But so there can be all kinds of reasons why you would have that 20%. It's really about the clarity of the person who is signing those forms and saying, is this somehow somebody who is possibly has Alzheimer's or, you know, struggling to get through this process, and do we need to make that call? So I don't envision a situation where escrow agents are making calls every day when these types of transactions are happening, but I think giving them a little bit of leeway to not sit back and be like, hey, I just had to be an objective observer because that's what the law says, I don't think that's an appropriate answer either.
Thank you, Representative. So I'll have Alan, Dale, and Marie come up. And just as an FYI to you guys, three of the members of the panel have to leave probably about in 5 minutes. So that's not an affront to you. It is just they need to leave in about 5 minutes. If they slam the door on their way out, then that is an affront to your testimony. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed in whatever order you'd like.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Marie Cervantes. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. I'm here today. I'm with Rebecca Fetter. She is sitting to my right, three rows back. She is the author of the financial exploitation study that we have conducted here for Oregon. It really details out the cost of abuse, something that we have not been able to do up until a couple years ago. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today and share some information. Every year, thousands of Oregonians over the age of 65 and people with disabilities are abused and neglected. Over 1,000 of those victims are financially exploited. National studies clearly show us that maybe 1 in 44 cases are ever reported. So we believe that the number of Oregonians that are financially exploited is actually much more than what our investigative reports show. One aspect of the financial exploitation is the wrongful taking of property, including real property. And this is where individuals are coerced, unduly influenced, who might be experiencing some diminished capacity, and find themselves very easily engaged in a transaction in which they sell their largest asset for well below its actual value. A study of Adult Protective Services financial exploitation investigation suggests that this exploitation involving real property makes up about 4% of our substantiated cases in Oregon. And although this sounds like a really small number, this is a very costly type of exploitation. It's not only costly to the victim, but the cost is very high because these cases have a high correlation that once folks are exploited, they often come onto Medicaid as a result of being exploited. The same study highlights the success that we've had with other members of the financial sector that have been reporting financial abuse, and that is the Oregon Bankers Association. They've willingly engaged with Adult Protective Services, and we work with them to develop a toolkit and associated training for the employees. The toolkit itself has gone across the desks of over 20,000 tellers in Oregon. The materials are designed to assist staff in identifying potential indicators of abuse and encouraging them to report. Much like their counterparts in real estate and title company industry, bankers are in a unique position to spot possible abuse. Years after the initiation of this banking effort, bankers now make up the largest group of reporters, and they are not mandated to do so. Our office frequently provides written and in-person information and training to any individual or group wishing to learn how to identify and report potential abuse. So we would willingly partner with any organization that has the same goal for their members or employees. In closing, two of our primary goals are to prevent abuse before it occurs and increase the reporting of abuse when it does. I will close with that and then answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. It just kind of appears that there might be slightly differing. I didn't mean to call you a debate-style panel. It's just nobody indicated whether they were for or against on here, so I assumed that there was continuity. So go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Dale Penn. I work for CFM. I represent the Oregon Land Title Association here at the Capitol. I've submitted testimony, so I won't spend too much time going over my different points, other than I wanted to just make another comment that the Oregon Land Title Association appreciates Representative Parrish bringing this issue forward. We look forward to working with her and other stakeholders on reducing financial elder abuse, especially in real estate transactions in Oregon. And we really feel that we appreciate the work that Representative Val Hoyle and Representative Vic Gilliam have done over the last 5 or 6 years in their elder abuse work group, where they bring together elder law attorneys, the ombudsman, DHS, many other stakeholders with expert opinions and advice on this subject matter to work through all of the problems particularly of the issue. And I know it's a complicated issue. So I just want to make a comment that OLTA will look forward to working with stakeholders on elder abuse, financial elder abuse. And with that, I'll go ahead and pass most of my time over to Alan Brickley here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Brickley. I am a member of the Oregon State Bar Association, but I am currently employed by First American Title. Our offices are at 121 Southwest Morrison in downtown Portland. I'm here also to testify on House Bill 2780, and I want to do two things in particular. One is to identify the particular climate that we are operating in as title insurers and as escrow agents. And secondly, just to express two sort of generalized concerns about the legislation proposed. I would reiterate what was already said, and that is our industry is very interested in working with interested parties to try to minimize this potential and serious problem that exists. What I wanted to point out that is not necessarily known by everyone, and that is that as most people understand, most transactions are closed in an escrow environment. But also as part of that escrow environment, a title insurer is generally speaking, the standard form does require that a owner's policy be issued in favor of the purchaser. That owner's policy contains protection against defects in title that are caused, and this is a quote, by forgery, fraud, undue influence, duress, incompetence, incapacity, or impersonation, which means as a title insurer, then we are very concerned that the sellers are capable of making an appropriate transaction and that none of these factors exist. So as a consequence, I would tell you that most companies have developed protocols for taking a look at these things, and there are three major factors that we look at before we escalate a transaction for further review by supervisors or in my case, myself as a counsel for the company. First of all, if our line people, the people who are actually signing them, have concerns about the competence of the person, there's going to be escalated and we're going to have some discussions. Secondly, if there is a disparity in the values that seems apparent, we're going to get a call and it's going to escalate and we're going to ask further questions. And the third thing, which is something that's not been mentioned here, but which I consider to be a very serious abuse, and that is what are generally referred to as flip transactions. Someone goes in, talks to a person, and says, you know, your property is only worth $100,000, but they already have in their pocket, often, or can get very quickly, a resale for $150,000 or whatever the number might be. And so they use the funds from the subsequent sale to pay the initial person, and that way they've defrauded the original seller. We apply these criteria to the transaction regardless of age. And I think that's particularly true in this flip transaction. Now, this number may be a little bit unusual, but I can tell you this week, Monday through today, we have three transactions in our company which we have either said, no, we will not close, or we want to look at this matter further before we're willing to ensure title to this property. One or more of these factors were in existence in every one of those situations. So it is a fact that we are concerned about this, that we are training people about it. Could we do a better job of training? Perhaps. And, you know, as I say, we'd be more than happy to work with other groups to enhance that training. But I would suggest that we are very cognizant of the problem and working very hard to make sure that it doesn't occur. The two major concerns I have with it is, one, this issue of value. I've heard various things in some of these transactions. Well, it's not really worth that because there's $70,000 worth of repairs that are required or whatever, you know. So there are issues about value. And I would tell you, notwithstanding the good work that our county assessors do, real market value on the assessment roll is not a particularly good indicator of value. The only real good indicator of value is a fee appraisal, and the emphasis on fee appraisal, so that if there is not appraisal that is generally available in a transaction, it strikes me that as a title insurer or as an escrow agent, the only safe thing we can do is to require an appraisal, so in order for us to identify whether or not they meet the 20% threshold. That kind of an additional expense and requirement in a transaction may certainly not be appropriate. The second thing that I'm concerned about, and it's already been alluded to, I think, is if we put additional requirements like this on a transaction in order to meet the terms of the statute, people are going to find alternative ways to close a transaction, and we will not be able to catch these people as we currently are. And again, thank you very much for your time and opportunity to discuss.
Thank you very much for your thorough testimony. And the members that needed to leave are now leaving, but are there any questions for the remaining members? With that, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2780. And is there anything else for the good of the order? All right, then I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.
Thank you.
Government Effectiveness.
Thank you.
Consumer Protection and Government